Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
How do we structure government systems that pool resources and hence facilitate some redistribution, because I actually believe in redistribution, at least at a certain level, to make sure that everybody's got a shot.
You could call this, in a neutral way, if we wanted to do that, is just a discussion on tax equity. We're going to have government, no matter who is the president, and you have to make just decisions on resources. Now, if you want this redistribution word, which is a word that I'm sure is intended to be befuddle people, because it's not a word that real people use.
Okay. Now you understand why they're not running this on the networks. Welcome to the Savage Nation. This is your president, way, way, way before he was a glint in the eye of the communists who put him in power, way before Soros ever heard of him, when he was just sort of an unknown guy. He was talking about redistribution. Now, as you know, everything about Obama is invented. There's virtually nothing that's real about him. He is the most fabricated individual in the history of American politics. The reason he has not been vetted is obvious. Had he been vetted, he wouldn't even be an FBI agent. In fact, had he been vetted, he couldn't become a Secret Service agent to protect himself. In fact, had he been vetted, he couldn't even be a Chicago cop. In fact, he's the most invented individual in the history of America. One of the best articles on this is a series of 10 articles that's just come out today in the Washington Examiner. That's astounding, by Mark Tapscott. He's the editor-in-chief. And it's in 10 chapters. A Childhood of Privilege, Not Hardship is chapter 1. And it talks about how First Lady Michelle Obama and her husband invented a life for themselves that was not real. And we're going to talk about that on the Savage Nation and ask how, in spite of the fact, or shall I say despite the fact, that Obama is a complete phony and a fraud, you're going to find out that he actually threw black people out of tenements in Chicago in the middle of the winter as a lawyer for a wealthy owner of these tenements. You'll find out other things he's done to the poor that have been buried by the drug addicts in the mainstream media. But before we go into the 10-part series on the Savage Nation, we will learn everything about Obama that the mainstream media has hidden. I want to talk about redistribution to show you how dangerous it really is. It sounds benign, redistribution. After all, you could say, well, by paying taxes, we're already redistributing wealth. The best and most concise article on this is by Thomas Sowell in Investors.com. I linked it on MichaelSavage.com for those of you who still read. His article is worth quoting. Fallacy of redistribution has grave economic impact. I wouldn't put it that way, but that's the way Thomas does. And I'm going to read you some of it. The recently discovered tape on which Barack Obama said back in 1998 that he believes in redistribution is not really news. But the tape surfacing may serve a useful purpose if it gets people to thinking about the consequences of redistribution. Those who talk glibly about redistribution often act as if people are just inert objects that can be placed here and there like pieces on a chessboard. But if human beings have their own responses to government policies, then we cannot blithely assume that government policies will have the effect intended. The history of the 20th century is full of examples of countries that set out to redistribute wealth and ended up redistributing poverty. The communist nations were a classic example, but by no means the only example. In theory, confiscating the wealth of the more successful people ought to make the rest of the society more prosperous. But when the Soviet Union confiscated the wealth of successful farmers, food became scarce. As many people died of starvation under Stalin in the 1930s as died in Hitler's Holocaust in the 1940s. How can that be? It is not complicated. You can only confiscate the wealth that exists at a given moment. You cannot confiscate future wealth, and that future wealth is less likely to be produced when people see that it is going to be confiscated. Farmers in the Soviet Union cut how much time and effort they invested in growing their crops when they realized that the government was going to take a big part of the harvest. Listen to this. They slaughtered and ate young farm animals that they would normally keep tending and feeding while raising them to maturity. People in industry in America, for example, are not inert objects either. Moreover, unlike farmers, industrialists are not tied to the land in a particular country. Financiers are less tied down, especially today when vast sums of money can be dispatched electronically to any part of the world. If confiscatory policies can produce counterproductive repercussions in a dictatorship, they are even harder to carry out in a democracy. A dictatorship can suddenly swoop down and grab whatever it wants. But a democracy must first have public discussions and debates. Those who are targeted for confiscation can see the handwriting on the wall and act accordingly. Now, he's an intellectual, Thomas Sowell. I'm not. I'm a mere talk show host. It's true that I have a PhD from a great university. It's true I've written 28 books. But I consider myself a man of the people. I'm not an intellect who would be invited to the Hoover Institution. But even I can understand what redistribution really means. It means that if the government becomes so onerous, the people who run factories, own factories rather, the people who build businesses, just stop building businesses. They say, the heck with it, I'm giving up. Let the government go to hell. I'm not even going to invest any more of my energy. I have enough money to screw them, and I'm leaving. That's how it works. And so those of you who are jealous of others in society who have better shoes, nicer cars, and prettier wives, you have to understand that eventually you wind up eating your own shoe leather if you keep following the line of Barry and Michelle. The phone number here is 1-800-449-8255. Now let's go into the series of 10 articles in the Washington Examiner on Obama, telling you everything you wanted to know about this Fugazi, but you were afraid to ask. Let's begin with Article 1, where you're going to find out that the Fugazi in the White House is far more of a fabrication than even I told you in Trickle-Down Tyranny. Shall I read it to you, or have you read it already? Or do you not want me to read it? Tell you what, I won't do it unless you want me to do it. Let's take the first caller from New York, W.R. First up, in the box, out the gate. Cameron, W.O.R., go ahead, bang. You're on the air.
When he says redistribution, Doc, he's talking about redistribution throughout the world to take the wealth of this country and spread it to the third and fourth world, which some people deny the existence of the fourth world, but we know there is a fourth world. And
do you believe that Obama has loyalties that lie solely with America? You're saying obviously you don't.
Certainly not. He's a child of the world, and he's
a man who believes that America is just one of many nations, not an exceptional one, of course.
And it's the one he happens to be living in now. And
right, and of course his wife felt the same way. She said she was proud of America for the first time when they elected the Fugazi to the White House.
Well, Dinesh D'Souza has told us all we need to know.
I don't know who that is. I never heard of him. But you say somebody with an odd name said what?
I'm just saying that the movie 2016 by Dinesh D'Souza.
All right, thanks for the call, a plug call. I don't take plug calls. I don't take plug calls. Thank you very much. Nice try. A childhood of privilege, not hardship. First Lady Michelle Obama told the DNC that Barack and I were both raised by families who didn't have much in the way of money or material possessions. It's a claim the president has repeated in his books, on the speech circuit, and in countless media interviews. By his account, he grew up in a broken home with a single mom, struggled for years as a child in an impoverished third world country, and then was raised by his grandparents in difficult circumstances. The facts aren't nearly so clear-cut. Ann Dunham was just 18 years old when she gave birth to Obama. She was a freshman at the University of Hawaii. His Kenyan father, Barack Hussein Obama Sr., was a few years older than Ann. They were married against family wishes. Oh, that's interesting. Which family? Were they racist? Oh, I didn't know that. Obama Sr. does not appear to have been welcoming or compassionate towards his new wife or son. It later turned out that he was secretly married to a Kenyan woman back home at the same time he fathered the young Obama. Oh, so it was the Kenyans who didn't want him to marry the white woman. I get it. He was a, in other words, he was a bigamist. You can't blame Obama for the fact that his father was a bigamist. See, I don't hold that against him. We cannot choose our parents. So that's neither here nor there. He abandoned Obama Jr.'s mother when the boy was one. In 1964, Dunham filed for a divorce that was not contested. Her parents helped to raise the young Obama. Obama's mother met the second husband, an Indonesian named Lolo Soetoro, while working in the East-West Center in Hawaii. I should divert here for a minute because it's strange. I was at the University of Hawaii shortly after that period, and I met some very, very strange doctor communists there who helped Obama get where he was. Only I didn't meet Obama, but I met the doctors who apparently were in the circle of communists who loved Obama. I'll go on now. They traveled to Indonesia with his mother when the Indonesian government recalled his stepfather. In Indonesia, the family circumstances improved dramatically. According to Obama in his autobiography, Lolo's brother-in-law, Lolo, who's Lolo? She married Lolo. Lolo's brother-in-law was making millions as a high official in the National Oil Company. It was through this brother-in-law that Obama's stepfather got a coveted job as a government relations officer with the Union Oil Company. The family then moved to Menteng, then and now the most exclusive neighborhood of Jakarta, where bureaucrats, diplomats, and economic elites reside. Okay? So they lived in a beautiful neighborhood in Indonesia. Graceful, beautiful neighborhood built by the Dutch colonial government in the 1920s. In 1971, his mother sent young Obama back to Hawaii, where his grandmother, Madeline, known as Toots, would become one of the first female vice presidents of a Honolulu bank. His grandfather was in sales. Obama's grandparents moved the same year into Punahou Circle Apartments, a sleek new 10-story apartment building just 5 blocks from the private Punahou School, which Obama would attend from 71 to 79. Now, let's pause right here. I lived in Hawaii myself from 68 to 74. So apparently, and we were in the islands at the same time, I never met Mr. Obama, but I met several of the communists at the university who I think would later on play a very important role in pulling the greatest scam on the American people. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Look, the important thing to remember is that everything about Michelle and Barry Obama that you've heard is a lie. And the reason you don't know the truth is because he was literally fabricated by the media and not vetted by the media. And now this 10-part series about the Obamas has come out in the Washington Examiner. As you well know, most Democrats don't read, and especially those who receive welfare don't read, except the food stamp quality and the quantity of food stamps they receive. They can count those. And the difference between those who vote for Romney and those who vote for Obama is expressed simply. Those who vote for Romney sign the check on the front, and those who vote for Obama sign the check on the back. Now, it's a funny joke, but it happens to be true. If it's 47% of the people don't pay any taxes, why shouldn't everybody pay taxes? Why shouldn't anybody who receives anything pay taxes toward the upkeep of the mandarins who run the country? After all, the money doesn't go for you, doesn't go for the people. It goes to the mandarin class. The mandarins with the long fingernails who run everything, they need to be paid. The Politburo of America, they need money. And so they should take it from the poor, the middle class, and the rich. And the reason we hear so much about the rich is because those are the only people that both parties pay any attention to anyway. And there's nothing wrong with being rich. Not every rich man is Resco. Not every rich person stole their money. Only those who support Obama. But the fact of the matter is, you can't tax people at 100% and expect them to keep working. So let's start with the first one. A childhood of privilege is what they both had. They went to very fine schools. For example, Obama went to Punahou High School. Obama admitted that his grandfather pulled strings to get him into the school. How many times have you heard about the poor and how he loves the poor and it has to be fair? There was a long waiting list, and I was considered only because of the intervention of Gramps' boss, who was an alumnus. It was one of the most expensive schools on the island, and both Obama and his half-sister, Maya Suetro Ng, received scholarships. Now, while the Dunhams were not among the wealthiest families on the island, he nevertheless studied and socialized with the children of the social and financial elite. Obama has said he didn't fit in at the school, but that's not how other Hawaiians remember it. AP writer Sudan Thanawala reported from Honolulu in 08 that classmates and teachers say Obama blended in well. He served on the editorial board of the school's literary magazine, played varsity basketball, and sang in the choir. He went on the occasional date. Nothing wrong with any of that. But the fact of the matter is, the man invented his past. Edward Shanahan, a retired newspaper journalist who now edits Downstreet.net and makes no effort to conceal his love for Obama, retraced his Hawaii years shortly after the president was elected. Shanahan wrote that Obama lived in a well-off neighborhood near the University of Hawaii, where Barry, as he was known, resided in a comfortable home with his mother and her parents before she took him to Indonesia. Shanahan said, "Our tour ended up at the lush, exquisitely maintained, and altogether inviting campus of Punahou School, which we can imagine was a place of great comfort for Obama." Now, let me pause right here. I lived in Hawaii at that time, and I left Hawaii because I couldn't afford to send my first child to Punahou. And I knew that if I had sent my first child to any school other than Punahou, he would have to fight every day of his life, or they would eat his lunch and steal his clothing, because the racism was inherent against white boys in Hawaii at that time. I know you don't want to hear it. I know it's uncomfortable. But you have to have lived in Hawaii to know about the hatred that was the racism in the form of the word haole, haole, haole. Haole is a derogatory term almost approaching the N-word and other derogatory terms that was cast at white people in Hawaii. I didn't want to subject my child to that. And unfortunately, I was a grad student, and I couldn't afford to send my kid to Punahou. So I moved to California at the time so that he could go to a public school, which is where he went. And it was a very good public school at the time. In fact, one of the happiest days of my life, if I look back on my whole life, was the first day of school for my firstborn in Marin County, California, when a little yellow school bus came and picked him up, and I knew he would be safe, and he wouldn't have to fight every day to hold on to his lunch. But, you see, Obama was luckier than my kids.
Savage.
Ah, yes, I could use a week in Hawaii right now. The nicest time of the year, incidentally, is late September, early October. I used to love this weather. Although it's beautiful weather in San Francisco right now. The most beautiful weather on earth is, I can see why real estate's out of the world here. I mean, it's unbelievable. Warm, yet cool, cold at night. I mean, cool at night, you know. You sleep with three blankets on you, Bay Air. But Hawaii at this time of the year is just magnificent. And I have very fond memories of Hawaii. Of all the islands, I love Oahu the best because I like a city if you want to go to it. I mean, there's nothing, what could be better than seeing tourists from Minneapolis in the middle of the winter with white knob knees and hairy legs walking down Waikiki? What could be better? Now, there's nothing wrong with it. Or people wearing black shoes and black socks and Bermuda shorts on Waikiki, shopping in an ABC store to buy a pint of booze. There's something eerily reassuring and eerily American about it, incidentally. I should say eerily human, reassuringly human about people who go on vacation and need to get stewed to get through the week, in that there's nothing there that they didn't have at home other than warm weather. And then they're terrified of the abyss, the emptiness of nothing to do with themselves. So they get drunk in the hotel room. They eat bad meals. They used to go to Don Ho. You know what they're listening to. There's nothing better. But if you got away from Oahu, from Honolulu's, I mean, you can get lost in the mountains back there. There's pig hunting back up in the hills. I lived in the back of I lived in the back of Oahu at a herbarium. It's unbelievable, in a little one-room cottage as a grad student. It's too rainy, too wet. But anyway, I have very fond memories of Obama's hometown, really, in that way. And there are rumors right now that you have to read about secret retirement plans. Does Obama expect to lose? by Jerome Corsi on WorldNet Daily. They say that a house is being bought for him by one of his chief financiers, Penny Pritzker from Chicago, where they're secretly buying him a $35 million house in Kailua. because they think he's going to lose. And that's not such a bad place to be. It's a gorgeous house, the ocean view, the staircase. Very nice. I mean, it's really beautiful. But anyway, he's not going to the big house, that's for sure. Even though what he's done to America would qualify most of us for the big house, he is going to go to a big house one way or the other, but not the big house. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. Penny Pritzker. Oh, that's of the Hyatt family. She's got nothing to do with the money. But why is it that billionaires' children or wives or whatever are all commies? What's wrong with them? What are they, psychotic? Is it the drugs? Is it I don't quite understand it. Don't they understand what they're doing? You mean she wants to give away more of her money to the commie regime? I don't quite understand this. Harris to the Hyatt Hotel's fortune. Penny Pritzker. Why are they in love with him? The man hates Israel. He's friends with the Muslim Brotherhood. He has pillaged the treasury. He has decimated the military. I mean, I can go on and on. What do you want me to do? I guess she's stupid. I mean, I've proven over and over again that very rich people are necessarily or not necessarily as smart as you may think. Sacramento, KSTE, Patrick, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Mike, my hero, how you doing?
What's up?
Yeah, I was calling. I grew up in California. I transplanted out to Kaneohe Bay, which is in northern Oahu. I was there for a short time when I was 5.
Oh, yeah, that you mean to the military base?
No. I wasn't in the military. Actually, my mother married a sports writer up there. So we transplanted over there. When I was 5 years old, I was a towhead. Long, just blonde hair, you know.
Oh, my God. I guess you were loved by the locals, huh?
Oh, yeah. I was loved very much so. I believe it was the second day of school in kindergarten. I don't quite remember it a whole lot. My mom tells me the story more. I come home with an envelope with my hair in it and a note written by the teacher saying, sorry, the local boys were beating up Patrick, calling him a howley, and they cut his hair off. I encountered that more than once in my short
time. But you see, Patrick, Patrick, your mother should have let them do it, because that's the eight howleys. And
yeah,
she should have let you be a sacrificial lamb. It's a cultural expression. It's not anything bad. And they should have been able to beat you and steal your lunch, take your clothing, whatever they wanted, because of the oppression, the hundreds of years of oppression of the missionaries, which you were personally representative of.
I was encroaching on their land, you know. I was there taking their land, and that's the way they treat me. I've been back numerous times since, and I've played more than one football games on the sandy beaches there when I had local boys want to come up and throw fists with me.
Oh, that's right. Of course. Well, because you don't belong there. You're a howley.
Yep.
But they sure like their American cars and their tubby boy diners, don't they?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I never saw a local car made by the Hawaii indigenous peoples of Hawaii. And they didn't make an indigenous hot dog stand either. Well, I mean, indigenous hatred is all they made. It's unbelievable to me. How they, you know what it is they get away with it because people are afraid to say this, and they're also afraid to talk about the real Barry Obama. That's the truth, and that's why we have the problem we have in this country today. Everyone's afraid to say reality of what's going on, and we're losing our world because of it. All right, I guess this is an uncomfortable moment for most listeners. They had to reach for their medication listening to that. Because, you know, when you hear the truth sometimes, it's like, what the heck did he just say? I thought everyone in Hawaii was peaceful. I thought everybody in Hawaii was loving. Well, it's like in Libya. It wasn't really an act of terrorism. It was a few bad apples who killed our ambassador, sodomized him, and burnt the embassy down. It was a few bad apples, even though the government's not sure about it because they're still studying it. And they sent the FBI over to muddy the waters to make certain we never know who actually did it. Now, remember, Obama said that whoever did it will be hunted down and brought to justice. The next day went to a fundraiser in Las Vegas, because you have to understand that Obama is so intelligent that even though he didn't actually go to Washington to work on the evidence of who killed our ambassador, he could do that from Las Vegas. He could sit in a hotel room in Las Vegas, and with intelligence briefings available on the internet today, he could find exactly what he needs to find out, which is that they don't care who did it, and nobody will be hunted down. Unless Media Matters or the Southern Poverty Law Center tells them who an enemy of the government is, This administration is not capable of finding any villains in the world. You understand that? The only villains in this country are those designated as such by the Southern Poverty Law Center or Media Matters. Actual terrorists who kill people are of no interest to this administration because there's no money in the pocket for that one. We have other people calling now. I don't know how they got into this now. Here's Spokane, Washington. Mike, welcome to the Savage Nation. Mike, I didn't mean to do this, but we're getting another call on this. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Mike. Yeah, I went to junior high and high school in Hawaii, and from the very first day, I was at a public school and got beat up all the time. And
Well, you got beat up why? Because you were a racist, evil white male, or just because of your skin color?
Well, you know, it's funny because my mom raised us to be very loving towards everybody. We lived in Alaska on an Indian reservation before we moved to Hawaii, and
your mom was sort of a multiculturalist.
Yeah, she was the typical Christian, you know, love everybody type of mentality. And when we got to Hawaii, I mean, it was just black eyes and bloody noses. And literally, when you said the lunch comment, that reminded me of, you know, when I got my lunch.
You got to understand, you were a symbol of white oppression. So you have to let the locals act out their feelings. After all, it's only right. Isn't that redistribution of violence? Isn't that something the liberals would agree with? Redistributing violence? Although you yourself didn't enslave anyone, didn't steal anyone's land, you were a symbol of such slavery and oppression. So you should have been a sacrificial lamb, according to MSNBC.
Well, in Alaska, I had all of my teachers were fishermen, halibut fishermen, and I got straight A's. And then in Hawaii, my schooling, you know, slipped, and I finally...
I left when my son was entering the first grade because I couldn't afford to send him to the elite school that Obama went to on a full scholarship. Now, as you well know, Obama didn't get in because he was a genius. He got in because his grandfather pulled strings, and he got him a full scholarship. I wish that I could have done that, but I couldn't. So I left because of the racism towards white kids, in plain English. I'm telling a story that's not easy to tell, nor am I doing it out of any maliciousness. I want people to understand that Obama came from a very, very plush, posh, protected background. People should know that. He didn't come from a very hard background.
Well,
That's the important point. Let's not lose the, you know... The school still features a lush hillside campus. It was one of the most expensive schools on Hawaii. And both Obama and his half-sister, Maya Soetro Ng, received scholarships. Now, if I could have gotten a scholarship for my firstborn, I would have stayed there. And today I'd probably be dead from sun poisoning. But luckily, I said, you know, this is another side note that's very important. People say they sacrifice for their children. It's not really true. If you're a young father or a young mother, and you think of your children before you think of yourself, you're actually thinking for yourself because you're thinking for the betterment of yourself. What you consider to be a sacrifice today, let's say you want to buy a new car, and you can't, I'll give you an example. In the 80s, my dream was to have a brown Porsche. I wanted it so badly. I wanted a chocolate brown Porsche with a bib on it so that it wouldn't get even a nick on its nose. I couldn't afford it. I had to put the money away, the little extra money I had, for my children's education. And I did. So I drove a broken Volvo. And I didn't like it. I hated the Volvo. I hated it. It was a piece of junk. Four on the floor, four cylinder. But it got me up to the High Sierras. It did its job. It drove across the country. It was fine. Okay. Well, what I'm saying is, I was thinking of the children and sacrificing for myself, just as when I left Hawaii, I left for my son. But it improved my life. Had I stayed in Hawaii, my life would have been a disaster. I would have amounted to nothing. I would have been just, you know, nothing if I had stayed there. But I came to California because it had a wonderful educational system. It was the number one in the country. Number one until liberalism destroyed the educational system in the state of California. It had been the best in the country when I came here. And I remember proudly thinking to myself, as a poor guy, my children could get the best education available at the lowest possible cost, because they had great schools at every level, law schools, dental schools, medical schools, engineering schools, you name it, and they could go to any level they wanted at very low cost. Now, all of that's changed, of course, with the influx of illegal aliens, with the takeover of the government by the leftist Democrat machine, which is the most corrupt machine ever seen in the history of California. There is no fairness anymore. There's just rape and pillage of the economy. And so now we have about the worst educational system in the country. But that's a second answer for a topic for another day. My main point is that Hawaii was not a very good place if you were a middle class or lower middle class person and white. And so I had to leave. But for Obama, he had a privileged life, and he went to an elite school because his grandpa got him in and got him a scholarship. And that's very good. I don't blame him. I don't blame him for that. 1-800-449-8255. But there's more in this article. Obama has never lived in a black neighborhood. Moranis reported in his book that when leftist activist Jerry Kelman interviewed Obama for a community organizing job in Chicago, he asked Obama how he felt about living and working in the black community for the first time in his life. Obama accepted the job, but chose not to live among those he would be organizing. Instead, he commuted 90 minutes each way daily from his apartment in Chicago's famous Hyde Park to the Altgelder Gardens housing project where he worked. It was an early instance of Obama's presenting himself one way while acting in quite a different way. He wasn't stupid. Why would he want to live there? What do you think? He wanted to have his lunch stolen? I'll be right back.
Savage.
Could you play some Hawaiian music? I like that. It's soothing for me. And if it soothes me, it soothes the audience. Even my dog looks happier just now. Lying here, he's happy. I'm drinking a diet soda. I just said to him, boy, that's delicious, Teddy. I said, it's the best drink in the world. It'll put hair on your chest. I said, wait a minute, let me take that back. Imagine if I could transplant a gene from a poodle into the scalp of a middle-aged man. My God, what a fortune that would produce. I don't know if you could do that. Can you just take a gene for hair on the scalp? Or might you look sort of like an ape and have hair grow everywhere? I was watching a movie the other night on TV. You know, I told you I'm a big movie nut. And it was, I think, Escape of the Planet of the Apes or Revenge. It was done like recently. Oh my God, was it good. Where scientists are researching Alzheimer's and they make an ape that's part man. And he conducts a revolt. He frees the apes from, you know, from the laboratory, and they go on a rampage. It's fantastic. They go across the Golden Gate Bridge. They fight with the CHMP and throw cars into the bay. It was so realistic. I was sitting up and cheering. I mean, I'm on the side of the cops, but in this case, I was on the side of the apes. I like seeing the cops being off the bridge. I mean, when they're shooting apes from a helicopter with a machine gun and nice apes are being killed, you naturally are going to cheer for the apes, aren't you? It just shows you the power of the movies. They could take somebody who is heroic in your mind and make them into the villain. And then they could, you know what I'm saying? This is what they're doing to our whole society. They're geniuses. Look, Katzenberg, Hatzenberg, Matzenberg, Spielberg, they're geniuses. They can turn the world upside down. They can make Adolf Hitler today look like a hero. If they wanted to, they wouldn't do that. Don't get me wrong. But if they wanted to, they could. The sufferings of young Adolf could be a bestseller if Katzenberg did it, who just bundled $6.6 million for Obama. If Katzenberg wanted to, he has enough genius at his disposal and enough power to do a new movie called The Sufferings of Young Yosef, let's say. And it would be the life and times and struggles of Joseph Stalin and how, although he killed 35 million Russians, he did so out of kindness. He didn't mean to. And although he seized the farms which were once bountiful in Russia and produced enough food not only for the Russians but for export, poor Joseph Stalin, he had a good idea. He had a plan of redistribution. And he thought that the farmers in Russia were evil capitalists. After all, they were making a profit on their corn, or whatever, the wheat rather, and the beans. And so he said they're evil capitalists, so he seized their farms. He called them kulaks. And he either imprisoned them in the Soviet gulag, or he executed them. And then, of course, he had government bureaucrats run the farms. And there were 30 million Russians who starved to death. It would be like having Janet Napolitano run the farms in America. I'm not saying her. someone like Russian equivalent in the 1930s, another genius like her. Well, let's say James Carney, the spokesman for Obama. You pick anyone in the government. Okay, Charles Schumer. Pick a government flack. And you say, okay, Schumer, you're running all of the farms in upstate New York. People would wind up eating tin cans. They'd be like billy goats if Schumer ran the farms in upstate New York. You understand what I'm saying to you? That's what government is capable of. Very little. They can't fill a pothole. So how are they going to raise food? So this is what I'm saying to you. This is what redistribution leads to. But don't tell that to the people who are saying redistribute, take from the wealthy, blah, blah, blah. They don't even understand what they're talking about. This is how it works. Communism yielded starvation and death. Now you say, well, in reverse, is naked capitalism the answer? I would say that the pirates in capitalism that we have today are criminals. And I've said so. I've written about it. I've named them. I said that their assets should be seized and they should be arrested. I said bring back the uptick rule. I said cut out the hedge funds. I've written all of that. So don't think I'm into the wild, crazy stuff that we see going on now on Wall Street where there's virtually no control over them. That's insanity. But all of this changed under Bill Clinton. That's when it started in a big way. But this is too big a story for the average listener. They're not interested. They'd rather I give them a poi recipe. But I must tell you, it's the most horrendous food I've ever eaten in my life, and so I don't have a good recipe for poi, which is ground-up taro root. Now, if I was starving, I would eat poi, but I never liked it. I did like boiled yam in Fiji. I must tell you that I loved boiled yam, and I learned from my Fijian friends that you had to boil that you had to boil taro root twice, or you would die from it or get very sick because of the microcrystallines in the root, meaning like glass. But they cleverly, over thousands of years, discovered that if you boiled the root twice and got rid of the water, you could eat the taro root. It was wonderful. But poi, forget about it.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. We're talking about, how do you want me to summarize what I talk about? I can't do it. Well, I will summarize it. There's a 10-part series in the Washington Examiner, A Childhood of Privilege, Not Hardship, really the Obama you don't know. The executive editor is Mark Tapscott, who's going to join us in the middle of the hour today on the Savage Nation. And you'll find out everything that you feared about Obama, but the mainstream media hid from you. Well, play the music, please. I really love that music today. Ann Dunham was just 18 years old when she gave birth to Obama. Nothing wrong with that. She was a freshman at the University of Hawaii. Nothing wrong with that. His Kenyan father, Barack Hussein Obama Sr., was a few years older than Ann. Nothing wrong with that. They were married against family wishes. Now, that's a loaded statement. I think the Kenyans didn't want Daddy Obama to marry the white girl. Woman, I think. Later turned out that he was secretly married to a Kenyan woman back home at the same time he fathered the young Obama. Again, nothing wrong with that. You can't choose your parents. See, this part of it doesn't bother me. He abandoned Obama Jr.'s mother when the boy was one. Can't blame Obama for that. Probably made him a better man that he was abandoned by his father. And so none of that matters. You can't choose your parents. And that she married another man who was an Indonesian this time, another Muslim, that doesn't matter. I mean, that she married two Muslims, that shouldn't raise any eyebrows in America. After all, if Obama says he's a Christian, that's what you believe. Isn't that true? And if he and Michelle say that they had a childhood of privilege, I mean of hardship, not privilege, that's what you believe. It's like the old joke. A woman comes home and finds her husband in bed with another woman. And the man has such control over his submissive wife that he points at her while he's with the other woman and says, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? So you've got to understand that if the Obamas tell you to believe something, you have to be like the wife cheated upon, and you have to continue to believe in them. You must, for your own sanity. Because, first of all, it's for your own good. It's for your own good that you continue to believe in them. Because the day you stop believing in hope and change, what have you got left? Nothing. There's nothing to believe in. You have to have a dream, right? Now, whether the dream is true or not doesn't matter. It's like believing in Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, Christmas, Hanukkah. It's like believing in the hereafter. It's like believing in anything. So since you can believe in Mickey Mouse, you can believe in Obama. You understand what I'm saying? If you can believe in Donald Duck, no, if you can believe in Mickey Mouse, then you can believe in Barry Obama's story of hardship. And that's the important thing, is to have belief. Because without belief, what are you? You're nothing. So you're more of a man when you believe a fabricator of truth. I guess my sarcasm is showing. You'll have to forgive me. I realize this is not a popular form of dialogue or a monologue in America today, in that very few people can do it for any sustained period of time. But I grew up in a very sarcastic home. I'm very lucky. In fact, I grew up in a very a competitive household, a very competitive household. We were pitted against each other, and it has worked for us, incidentally. What's wrong with a competitive household? Would you rather grow up in a household where everyone is love and peace and everyone gets along? You don't wind up doing it. You can't make anything of yourself in that kind of household. Look what it did to Mitt Romney. I'm just joking. Stop. I think that it's very important to grow up in a competitive household. So for Obama to grow up in a household without a father and really have to raise himself actually made him a better man when you think about it. If I keep this up, I'll wind up voting for him. I better watch out. I mean, the more I read about his childhood, the more I like the guy. Am I getting your attention yet? Is anyone listening to the show today? Where is everybody? I mean, where's Romney? I don't understand it. It's a slam dunk that America is disappointed. The left is disappointed. Let's start with this. Let's start with the left. The left is disappointed in Obama. The Hispanics are disappointed in Obama. Why? Because he didn't do enough for them. The food stamp people are disappointed in Obama because it didn't come with a new Cadillac. Not as bad. He got him on food stamps, but he didn't give him a new car, as they hoped. Disappointed with him, but they'll vote for him anyway, because they don't like Republicans. So now we have the other side of the aisle. And what you have is a disaster, a rolling disaster. It's like a snowball that's been melting in the heat. That's Romney's campaign. A tiny little snowball that's already melted down to the size of a pea, because the man is making one mistake after another. The man's going on The View for the third time, won't come on The Savage Nation for the first time. Ann Romney is going to subject herself again to being the prom queen on another television show when she should just step out of it, stay away, get out of the picture. Stop it, Ann. Stop it. We're not voting for you, Ann. We're voting for Mitt versus Barry. It's not a popularity contest at Vassar. Okay, let's put it to you that way. But look, I see the world one way, you see the world another. I read that Liddy retired from radio. Watergate burglar G. Gordon Liddy, who left prison for a career as a conservative radio, I wouldn't say successful career. He left for a career in radio, is retiring after 20 years. He's 80-some-odd years old. 82. Liddy said he was getting long in the tooth and he's eager to spend time with his 12 grandchildren and one great grandchild. It's been a good ride, said Liddy, but I'm finished. I liked him. Very good. And he did a nice job. That's all. How many years has he been on the air? He got a retirement party. You know what? I'll get nothing. He's retiring after 20 years on radio. I've been on radio since 94. I'm not ready to retire. I'm nowhere near ready. I don't know. I'm not ready to retire. I'm going to do something. And so 20 years in radio and he's retired, but he's got all these grandchildren. He says, Obama is, in my view, a Muslim, not a Christian. Ooh. His favorite political moment was in George Bush winning both elections. I still have his bumper sticker on my diesel pickup. All right. On Wednesday night, he was feted by the Competitive Enterprise Institute and Shirley, a man in public affairs, we told him. I'm not going to be feted by the Competitive Enterprise Institute because I'm not a Republican apparatchik. Me, nothing. No, nothings. Anyway, he did a good job. And he never ratted anyone out, Liddy. incidentally. Never ratted anybody out. Did he rat anybody out? He was not a fugazi. He was a good guy. What would you like to talk? It seems like a dead show today. I could feel it. I don't know what it is. I feel it in my gut. I've had a bad couple of days physically. Am I doing a good show or not? Because I'm not doing a good show, I'll do a best of right now. Buddy needs to hear he's doing a good show. Okay, you got to call the show right now. If you want me to continue on the air today, you got to call 1-800-449-8255 and tell me why I should continue on radio today. Otherwise, I'm going to go to a best of at the break and take a breather. I may go to Hawaii tomorrow for a week. I need a break. For me to get through the Republican convention, those stiffs, those imbecilic stiffs, and then get through the America Jew-hating Democrat convention, what do you think about God? No, nay. Okay, the A's have it. What do you think about Jerusalem as the eternal capital of Israel? Boo, screw the Jews. No. All right, the A's have it. I mean, I had to sit through that for a week. That was something. So I figured I'd take a vacation. Then, boom, what happens? Bingo, the sodomy and the killing of the ambassador. Again on the air. Then I got hit with a strange ailment. I went to the funeral last Thursday of the CHP officer. For some reason, you know, cops get killed. I don't like it. I hate it. Soldiers get killed. It hurts me. I send money to them anonymously. No one knows it. This killing got to me. So when I went to that funeral last Thursday, it was a stress beyond belief. First of all, I'll be honest with you. I haven't been to a funeral since 1970 when my father died. That was a long time ago. You hear this? I'm not a guy who goes to a lot. So the casket, the widow with the four young children, the dignity of all of the CHP officers, it just got to me. And I got sick after that, shortly after that. I got some intestinal discomfort that went on for 5-6 days. And I'm still not out of the room. Something hit me in the guts. You know what I'm saying? I got a blow, a body blow from it. And I haven't been, you know, up to, you know, whatever, but I'm still on the air. I need a vacation. Play the Hawaiian music. I want to hear the Hawaiian music. You want me on? Buddy needs to know if he should stay on the air today. Buddy needs to know that his audience is still there. I can't say Republican or Democrat one more second. I think it's a pretty big given that we're living through the greatest propaganda exercise in the history of America, owing to the drug media. I wouldn't even call them sellouts. You can't call people who are on drugs a sellout. Look at Tom Brokaw, who mixed up his medications and took a sedative in the morning and collapsed. How many years have I told you the mainstream media, they're on drugs? I bet you 95% of them are drugged. Prescription drugs now. I don't mean crack. Probably 5% are on crack. That would be their bosses who you never see. They're in the back room snorting coke or inhaling a crack. How else could they do these things on a daily basis? Attacking America, attacking the military, attacking mother, attacking father. It's unbelievable to me. And they get paid for it with their silver tongues. What, not one caller on this subject. Or here's one from Hawaii. Brett, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yeah, no, just stay on the air. Hang in there. I enjoy your best of, but I need you today. Dr. Savage, I need you.
What do you need of me? What would you need of me today?
Well, you're the uncle, you know. A lot of us need
so even when Uncle Savage is feeling a little off, it's better than no Savage.
Well,
all right, I get that. I know you need the spunky Savage to make sure that your life is still in place. I swear to God. You know, when you've been on the air for 18 years, as I have, you and those people who love your show, whatever it is, they're with you in good moments, bad moments, brilliant moments, stupid moments. They become like an extended family, and they want to hear you there. You're a part of their daily life. You're a part of the mental geography of these people. I mean, they turn the radio on. If you're not there, they get scared. Like, it's an emptiness. It's a funny thing. I used to feel that when I would leave the San Francisco Bay Area. The others who had decimated everyone who was of any value. I would leave the area, and when I came back in a taxi from the airport, the first thing I'd do was turn on a talk show, even if it was a liberal talker from the Bay Area. If it was a familiar voice, I wanted to hear it. They became a part of, you know, of my background, of my foreground, or whatever. Right now, there's no one to listen to in the Bay Area. They're all shills for one thing or another. So we're talking about this, we're talking about that, the voting already started, you don't even know that. Ready, set, vote, early voting begins. 47 days away? And Sean Hannity doesn't have a clock ticking yet? Beowulf, does the Tin Man have a clock ticking yet? What did they say they called him in Atlanta? The Tin Man or the...
Oh, Hanny Pie.
Hanny Pie. Hanny Pie doesn't have a clock ticking yet? I'll be right back.
Not yet.
Savage.
The city superintendent of schools banned father-daughter and mother-son activities after a mother went to the American Civil Liberties Union complaining that her daughter felt left out of a father-daughter dance. The girl has no father or father figure in her life.
Well, that's what you want is an equitable society. And so Cranston, Rhode Island stopped permitting father and daughter dances due to the complaints of one. And I think that that's reasonable. I think that, first of all, this is privilege. If you have a mother and a father in your household, I think the government should step in and remove the father from the household altogether in order to make it fair. Put him in prison, father, and they'll all feel equal. You see, we're living in a society that's disequitable in every way, whether it be a family that sticks together for the children. That's passé. It's very Christian. That has to, go. Money. Why should some have more money than others in the communist Obama universe? It should be an equitable. Everyone should have a fair share, an equal share. After all, if you've not read Animal Farm, you ought to read it now and find out how revolutions really work. Now let's listen to Michelle Obama campaigning in North Carolina telling a big whopper.
Here's what I know for sure. Barack Obama has been working every day since the day he took office. He has been fighting for us. He has been struggling with us.
He's been working every day since he took office. Now, does that include the golf games? Does that include the fundraisers? Does that include Martha's Vineyard? Does that include Hawaii? Does that include, I don't know what she means by working. Maybe fundraising is considered part of a job today, part of the job of a president. I know he's been working around the clock to make certain that we don't remember what went on in Libya. He said he would find the person who killed our ambassador, but thus far he's been fundraising, so you know you'll never find out who killed the ambassador. And if you do, he's liable to wind up working for the ACLU anyway. You'll never find out any more than you need to know about the economy and why it's wrecked. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. I've got callers galore. In a few minutes, we have the author of that 10-part series, A Childhood of Privilege, Not Hardship, from the Washington Examiner. An unbelievable, you're not going to want to miss this, I swear to you. I wouldn't have done it otherwise. Mark Tapscott of the Washington Examiner telling you everything about Obama that you need to know, but everything about Obama you need to know that Woody Allen wouldn't tell you. Victorville, California, April, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Oh, hello, Michael. And, you know, I just want to tell you that you could be talking about wallpaper peeling, and I'd want to listen to your show. You are so endearing and passionate about politics, and sometimes you're irritating, but I just absolutely love your show, and sometimes I will sit in the car for 2 hours. Because
that's good. That's very good. Then I'm gonna make your day. I'm sending you an early Halloween present, and that's a copy of Trickle Down Tyranny. Is that the first holiday coming up? Is Halloween? What's the next thing a poor working person has to look forward to? Beowulf, what a country, my God. There's nothing between Labor Day and Halloween, a witch holiday? Halloween is, have you ever noticed how America gets behind Halloween? Like the parents go crazy. Devil costumes, things on the lawn. You can't put a creche up, but you could put a devil up. You could put witchcraft, voodoo on your front lawn. That's approved by the vermin at the ACLU. See, if I were a president, the first thing I'd do is arrest everyone in the ACLU and let them prove themselves innocent. Okay? You say, well, wait a minute. What about fairness of trial? What, they have not exhibited who they are by now? I'd seize all of their assets. Then Media Matters. All assets seized unto the fourth cousin. Then Bernie Madoff.
Savage. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Savage Nation. We're going to talk about the Obama You Don't Know, an amazing 10-part series that appeared today in the Washington Examiner. The executive editor is Mark Tapscott, who joins us. This should be a book. Mr. Tapscott, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Well,
what motivated? Unbelievable. What motivated this 10-part series on Mr. Obama?
Well, we are just a bunch of journalists here that wanted to know the truth and felt like things had not been vetted properly in the 2008 campaign, and so we decided to take another look at Mr. Obama and his account of his life and his experiences, and we found some things that he apparently forgot.
Well,
aren't
you violating the protocols of Pravda by daring to publish such a series without asking permission of Mr. Obama himself?
Well, my understanding of journalism is that we're supposed to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. So you
don't ascribe to the Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, NBC, ABC School of Journalism. In your first chapter, A Childhood of Privilege, Not Hardship, you pretty much blow the lid off the myth that the Obamas suffered somewhat as a child. In fact, they had a kind of plush childhood. Both of them did. Isn't that true?
Well, as a matter of fact, they, Barack Obama especially, had. We have to admit he did have some difficulties in his childhood because of his parents' situation. Any of us would if we were in the same kind of deal. But from the perspective of the kind of opportunities that he had, the social milieu that he was able to grow up in, the economic status that he had as he was growing up, it certainly was not an underprivileged childhood.
So chapter one, I read the article for the audience today on the Savage Nation, A Childhood of Privilege, Not Hardship in Hawaii. It was very interesting. What is chapter two about in the series in your newspaper, The Washington Examiner?
Well, you may recall from the 2008 campaign, a great deal was made of the fact that he called himself a constitutional law professor at the University of Chicago.
Right.
And in fact, he wasn't actually a professor. He was a lecturer.
Oh.
Which is kind of a...
Well, wait a minute. Now, look, you and I both know that's simply not that big a deal to the Democrat, whether you're a lecturer or a professor. It's more or less... If you feel you're a professor, aren't you a professor?
Well, if you're a professor, you are going to very likely have tenure and a much higher salary. If you're a lecturer, you basically are a part-time contract employee. It makes a big difference.
But you say in Chapter 2, the myth of the rock star professor. What does that refer to?
Well, Time magazine described him as precisely that, a rock star professor. And we went in and looked at the student evaluations of Barack Obama, the students who actually took his courses over the 11 years that he was a lecturer. And their ratings, the first 2 years, he was pretty popular, but from that point forward, he steadily went down, and in the last 4 or 5 years, he was among the least popular of the professors. So, rock.
Well, here's the part in your article that really struck my... You know, okay. Obama's byline did not appear in a single legal journal while he took... Does that mean he never wrote a legal article?
Right. That's exactly what it means. He did write a book.
Isn't that unusual for a law school professor not to write a single legal article?
Well, it's especially unusual for a law school professor, and it's especially unusual for a law school lecturer at the University of Chicago, who people who have those positions then and now are expected to publish legal articles. And in fact, three of the folks that were also lecturers at the time Obama was there and who were also sitting federal judges published between them about 170 such pieces. So it can be done.
As a former university person myself, I certainly know what you're referring to, but the average listener doesn't understand what you're saying, I don't think. You say federal judge Richard Posner, who was at the same faculty at the same time, published 132 articles between 1993 and 04, and federal judge Frank Easterbrook, also a legal scholar on the same faculty, published 32 legal articles from 92 to 04, while Obama published no such articles.
A legal article in that context is very simply this. Legal professors, lawyers, academics, judges, and so forth talk and debate and discuss with each other through legal journals, law journals, about issues that are currently in focus in the courts or have been or may be in the future. And it's very much part of the ongoing legal community's discussion about what the law means and how it should be administered. He didn't participate in that.
What about when he was at Columbia, Harvard Law? How did he become the editor of the Law Review? How did that happen if he hadn't published anything?
What we found in looking at that, and we actually did not include this material in the special report that was published today, the whole process for becoming the head of the Harvard Law Review at that time was very much a political process. And contrary to the story that was put out in 2008, he was not a unanimous choice by any means. He was not even the only minority candidate. There were three others. And ironically, after literally, I believe, about 17 hours in this marathon political bargaining session among all the candidates and the voters on the review staff, Obama emerged the winner when the small caucus of conservative students on the staff, law students on the staff, for reasons known only to them, threw their support behind Obama.
Wow. Sounds like they were Republicans of today, in some regard. But the myth of the rock star professor is very intriguing, and it's part of a larger series, of course, the Obama You Don't Know. If you, as the executive editor of this series, were to be asked, what do you think is the greatest revelation in all 10 chapters? Could you reduce it to the single biggest revelation?
I think the most surprising one is that we found an obscure case while Obama was practicing law in Chicago, where he defended a slumlord in Chicago who had tossed out a bunch of his low-income tenants.
Oh, no, that's such an important story. Mark, that's a big one. I remember that now. He was a lawyer representing a slumlord, and the slumlord evicted, was it not poor black people from a housing project after cutting off their electricity and water?
Absolutely, and refusing to turn it back on for a month. And what he did is he forced them out without benefit of an eviction process, which basically told them to get lost.
Obama was the legal eagle behind this?
He was the slumlord's lawyer, and there's more to it than that even. But the bottom line on that particular case is Obama got him off with a $50 fine. Prominent.
That's a big fine. That's a big fine in Chicago political circles. $50.
Common in those days, and probably the point isn't either. But the man, the slumlord that we're talking about, is Reverend Brazier, who was a slumlord, a pastor in a very big church, and most important, was very much a figure in the liberal political establishment in Chicago and a big, big backer of Barack Obama.
I think we need to go back to this because, truthfully, if Romney had any. Well, let's put it this way. Romney should mention this slumlord past. No matter what is asked of him, he should work it into his answers. He won't do that, of course. He's too nice a man. But I was shocked to read this, that Obama was the lawyer, never mind professor. It was after law school. He was a lawyer who represented a slumlord who turned off the heat and water to the poor and then threw them out in the streets without any alternate housing. And Obama orchestrated the whole thing as the lawyer. Is that more or less a fair summary of what you discovered?
Well, I wouldn't say that he orchestrated the whole process. What he did do, without any doubt, is he defended the process and got the slumlord off with a $50 fine.
Isn't that politics as usual in Chicago, though?
Very much, and that's exactly the point. Obama has presented himself over the years as an idealistic civil rights lawyer, a community organizer who's interested in helping the poor, and an idealistic politician. The truth is, based on what we found, the truth is he's really just another Chicago machine politician.
The series is The Obama You Don't Know in the Washington Examiner, 10 parts. I posted it up on michaelsavage.com. I'm looking forward to reading a piece of it every day. But that, to me, was the greatest shock. In other words, all the other stuff I was very interested in the details, you know, about the invented hardship, really it was privilege, this and that, the association with seedy people, no publication of law articles. But I had no idea that he was a sleazy lawyer for a slumlord. That unto itself should sink his campaign, I would think, Mark. I know you're a journalist and I'm not a journalist. I'm a rebellious commentator, so I'm allowed to say things like that. But don't you think that would be a revelation in the campaign?
Well, this should have been a revelation in the 2008 campaign. It wasn't, because so many of my colleagues in the media, unfortunately, have been and continue to be conscious or unconscious. Doesn't really make any difference. The bottom line is they're basically protecting and advocating on behalf of Obama. And that.
Let me. What has the reaction been to your series? Just appeared today, didn't it, Mark? So, have you had any response from the so-called mainstream media?
Nothing directly. I'm sure that that we will, and frankly, we expect a very negative reaction from the White House. And I suspect that a good part of the news media will ignore it because, frankly, it ought to embarrass them. They didn't report this.
Chapter 10, Obama brings Chicago politics to Washington, and one of your editors writes, Chicago has been called the home of gangster government. How bad is it? And you spell it out. Gangster government. How bad is it? Many of us in America believe that we have gangster government running the country today. You think that that's a fair analysis?
Absolutely, I do. And the editor who coined that term, gangster government, is Michael Barone, who many of your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with, because he's one of the editors and was the founder of the Almanac of American Politics, which is an absolutely essential source for anybody who's really interested in what's happening in American politics. And
you say that, I'm sorry, you say Barone defined gangster government as using the powers of public office, quote, to transfer the property of one group of people to another group that is politically favored, close quote. Boy, does that ever describe what's going on in this country today with the fake solar contracts, with stimulus funds that have disappeared, trillions of dollars gone up in smoke. We don't even know where the money is.
Well, actually, we do know where it is. It's in the pockets of Obama's friends and political supporters.
Well, isn't that a crime?
Well, let's not forget we're talking about Chicago politicians, and they are the world's masters at covering their tracks. It's very difficult to prove. But the bottom line is, as we report, three of every four of the $20 billion in clean energy loans that have gone out under Obama went to companies that his supporters, friends, and political donors own, manage, or otherwise have an interest in.
You quote the book, Throw Them All Out, the 2011 book by Peter Schweitzer, and you say that 31 Obama bundlers and big donors whose firms received more than $16 billion in clean energy loans and grants include Gore, Silicon Valley Venture Capital King John Doerr, Sergey Brin, that's of Google, Dan Reicher and Larry Page of Google, Jim Rogers of Duke Energy, Tesla Motors, Elon Musk, wait, and CNN founder Ted Turner. How did Ted Turner wind up getting a clean energy loan? For what?
Well, it's a company that he has an interest in, and I don't remember the specific details of his. But
well, you know what? Well, here's the thing, Mark. This should be discussed by Romney. This is what Romney should be talking about, don't you think?
Well, I certainly think anybody who's interested in what's going to happen in this election ought to be talking about it, because it's bears directly on whether or not the incumbent president should get another 4 years. If you want four more years of that stuff, vote for him.
Yeah, with reappropriation of people's money. Incredibly, Obama You Don't Know, 10-part series by the Washington Examiner. With us on this topic was Mark Tapscott, the executive editor. And Mark, I want to thank you very much. I will be reading from this over the next few days. Incredible journalism. I'm proud to be an American today, and I'm proud to say there's still a journalism alive in the country.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mark. I'll be right back on the Savage Nation.
Savage.
Here are some of the headlines that will not make it to your local useless rag. Republican senators decry useless, worthless Clinton briefing on Libya attack. They said they've never seen anything like the lies that came out of their mouths. It was like an hour of filibustering. They divulged nothing about who killed the ambassador. Nothing. They're still going on and on about the video. So that's topic number one. Topic two that you won't read about in tomorrow's newspaper. State Department was discussing putting Marines in Libya sometime in the next 5 years. Oh, well, after all, you can't have those guys guarding an embassy. They're the guys with the guns. I mean, they actually use them. You certainly can't give them bullets. I mean, you can let them have wooden guns, sort of, you know, that kind of thing. But you can't give the Marines actual guns to guard an embassy. They might actually kill the bad guys. Then where would the bundlers go? I mean, if you want bundlers from the Middle East, you can't kill the terrorists because some of them are their brothers. What else do you want to hear about in the Savage Nation that you won't read about in tomorrow's newspaper? The useless, worthless lies coming out of the Obama administration? Yeah, okay, we'll talk about that. Finally, White House says it's self-evident that the 9/11 Libya attack was a terrorist act. This is while Obama's still saying it was a result of the video. Jay Blarney, White House press spokesmouth, Jay Blarney, after insisting for more than a week that the White House had no evidence to suggest that the deadly attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi was anything but a spontaneous act, he finally conceded that it was an act of terror. I believe the president. I thought Dear Leader was telling the truth when he went on television this weekend and said that it was a spontaneous protest that turned violent as a result of a few bad, rotten apples. Because everyone in Libya, as you well know, is a peace-loving individual. The only bad guy was Muammar Gaddafi, who Hillary celebrated when he died. We came, we saw he died. We have a kinder, gentler world as a result of Hillary Clinton, Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, subways to nowhere, solar plants that produce a fewer megawatts than a drop of sand in the sun. Mark in Houston, Texas, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thank you, Michael. You make my day every day.
How do I make your day, even when I'm not feeling well, as I am now, kind of? I'm not feeling bad, but what is it about me that makes you listen to this show? Really, I need to know to keep me going.
When there's not much to laugh about, you make me laugh. I mean, but I've got the home run, the grand slam for Romney in the debates.
What is it? I want to hear it.
He needs to end the debates this way. What was the price of milk, Mr. Obama, when you took office? It was $1.99. Today it's $4.
He could ask him, what was the price of a lid of marijuana when you took office? And what is it today as a result of high energy costs? I mean, you know, it could be milk, it could be marijuana. What's the price of crack today compared to when you took office? That might affect the food stamp recipients' vote. More than talking about milk, because they use the food stamps for crack, not milk. I mean, they don't buy milk for their babies with the food stamps. They go right to the crack dealer and trade it for the drug. That's how it works. You got to keep the underground economy working, don't you? Or somehow. Number of able-bodied adults on food stamps doubled after stimulus change study finds. Oh, ho-hum. Like we didn't know that. New government study found that the number of able-bodied adults on food stamps nearly doubled after Obama used the stimulus law to lift the key work requirement. Ugh, no kidding. So in other words, you don't have to work, in other words, to get the food stamps anymore. Why should you work? Isn't getting a food stamp work enough for Obama? Isn't it self-evident that going to an office, even opening an envelope, to get the food stamps is the equivalent of work? It's the equivalent of a man getting up at 5 in the morning and going to his second job. Is opening a food stamp envelope from the government, is that not work enough? Isn't that humiliating for a man to have to receive a food stamp? Is that not work enough? I don't understand you people, what you expect of an average human being. I think just getting a food stamp is so humiliating that they should be able to go out and get high for the rest of the day.
Savage.
Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show,
the Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Well, let's start with this. Here's what's on MichaelSavage.com. Gallup has it at 47-47. We know that they're in the pocket of Obama and the Chicago machine, so that means Romney's ahead. Obama approval slumps to 46%. Jewish support down 7% in Florida. Hey, here's an interesting one. A Virginia Democrat says there should be a minimum tax for everyone. I guess that would be the 47% who don't pay any taxes at all. Hey, even 1,000 a year would work, right? New Romney ad focuses on seniors and women, not on conservatives. I guess he feels he has that all wrapped up. Meanwhile, the Muslims are still burning, looting, and killing. And France tightens embassy security over cartoons. Magazine editor under armed guard. So you have the First Amendment, freedom of speech, versus throwbacks. And guess which side the liberals are on? Say throwbacks. Also, if you've not seen my new book, Train Tracks, you can see it on the bottom of michaelsavage.com with a couple of childhood pictures. I know you're going to love it for the holidays, and you can order it right now on Amazon. That's Train Tracks, my memoirs. Also on michaelsavage.com, the most important article today is a series of 10 articles on Obama. You'll never believe it. A 10-part series, A Childhood of Privilege, Not Hardship. He and Michelle were lying from day one about who they actually are. One of the best, second best article is by Thomas Sowell. Redistribution has grave consequences. You must read the article. I linked it on michaelsavage.com. Remember the liars at Gallup had Carter up 4 points in September of 1980. He was up 8 over Reagan in October, but lost by 9. So you know what that's all about. Meanwhile, Leon Panetta is in China telling the Chinese that the U.S. is not trying to contain them. Of course not. Of course he's not trying to contain them. He works for them. Antarctic sea ice is not melting. It sets another record. It's the most ice ever recorded on day 258 of the calendar year. Don't tell that to Al Gorleone and the brainwashed masses of global warmingists. Remember, the most important thing you can read on MichaelSavage.com is the 10-part series, A Childhood of Privilege, Not Hardship, about Michelle and Barry Obama. They were really well off. Not rich, but they never worked a day in their life. It's all a lie. Here's some of the audio we have today on the Savage Nation. More snotty nonsense by chicks makes excuses for why they won't play a tape, which makes Obama look like what he is, a redistributing communist.
After Mitt Romney's tough day fighting the blowback over those remarks in May, President Obama has his own leaked tape to deal with, we think, featuring comments he allegedly made back in 1998. I should point out that at NBC and MSNBC, we have not verified the accuracy of that tape from Loyola, so we are not playing it.
And here's the liar, the man with a chill up his leg, Chris Chill Up His Leg Matthews, teaming up with Charles Schumer to attack Romney.
What is wrong, by the way, with redistribution? I think that's what we do every time we help anybody out.
Well, first, it shows how desperate they are to come up with the tape. They probably had it in their back pocket. It didn't just pop up. But they're trying to change the subject. It's not working.
The talking heads at More Snotty Nonsense by Chicks do not understand what is bad about wealth redistribution.
This redistribution word, which is a word that I'm sure is intended to be befuddle people because it's not a word that real people use.
They ought to check their history books on the Soviet Union. Now the Anti-Christian Liberties Union is going after father-daughter dances.
Family events like father-daughter dances have been a tradition in Rhode Island schools for decades. But now Cranston's superintendent says the events can no longer be gender-specific. The Cranston decision came after the ACLU sent a letter to school leaders on behalf of a concerned parent. The ACLU tells NBC 10, quote, in the 21st century, public schools have no business fostering the notion that girls prefer to go to formal dances while boys prefer baseball games.
How did it come to this? Michelle Obama lies when she says the president is just like you. Well, I'm not a communist. He's not like me.
Here's what I know for sure. Barack Obama has been working every day since the day he took office.
He has been fighting for us. He has been struggling with us.
If there was even a modicum of fairness in the media, Obama's career would be over. Because his the linchpin of his entire foreign policy was the Arab Spring. He didn't conceive it. He didn't fund it initially. It was funded by the wonderful genius George Soros. It was then life was breathed into this fire of the Arab Spring by George Soros, who then passed it on to the other genius from the South named whatever his name, Jimmy Carter, who's just never met an Arab he didn't like. Can't say, the reverse is true about Jews. Brzezinski, another genius, whose daughter's on MSNBC, a wholly owned subsidiary of General Electric, pays no taxes. So, in other words, in a normal time, this would be the end of Obama's administration. His career is over. But the eye-altering alters all. I'm trying to tell you that the leftists in the media have the same, I don't know what word to use, the eye-altering alters all. They see everything wrong. I define it another way. Liberalism is a mental disorder. I'm not Blake. Liberalism is a mental disorder. The world's burning and they're blaming Romney. The world's burning and they're blaming Romney for uttering a few mild words about Obama. That's his job, idiot. Not only is he the leader of the opposition party, but he's running against them. He's supposed to utter criticism, schmuck. That's how it works. I mean, unless you want to live in Jim Jones's world or you want to, you know, live up in Bhagwan Sri Obama's world in Oregon. You're supposed to criticize the president, especially during a campaign, schmuck. But if you're an academician, instead of seeing the phrase, the eye altering alters all by William Blake and understanding what that means, which is that once you see things wrong, everything is seen wrong. What you do is you write an academic treatise that begins like this. In the current climate of critical diversity and methodological experimentation, it is natural to speculate on the value of various critical theories in approaching the notoriously recalcitrant work of William Blake. Among the plethora of such approaches, two that reveal a striking affinity with Blake's own aesthetic theories and practice are E.H. Gombrich's concept of the beholder's share and Wolfgang Eisser's phenomenologically based theory of reader response. Blake's work is, of course, in no way reducible to the concerns of those of these or any other critical methodologies and so forth and so on. That's the kind of stuff that that Obama listened to for 20 years in the universities. That's the kind of stuff that is discussed inside the CIA today. The men are gone, and what you have now are the academic gals over a coffee clutch discussing the Middle East in with the altered eyes. The eye that alters all. The eye altering alters all. That explains it all, but you have to understand why Obama's behaving this way. He's in denial. You want to put it in a simple sense. Doesn't accept what's going on around him. This is it. Should be over. The world is burning. The left-wing newspapers in Germany said, why, the conservative media have already labeled the anti-U.S. protests in Egypt, Libya, and Yemen as a wildfire and interpreted them as a result of Obama's weakness. Well, hello, wake up today. Going on around the world, what would you call that? Not a wildfire? How about a bonfire? It's not a prairie fire. Left-wing phrase, by the way. This is not a prairie fire. See, the left always wanted a prairie fire in America, meaning a prairie fire of revolution, right? Instead, they got it exactly where they didn't want it, in the Middle East. The Middle East is burning, and their boss, Bhagwan Sri Obama, their guru, it's his plan. The Europeans who have any education, left, right, and center, know Obama has failed. He thought that by adopting a new tone, they would love him. They would eat at Arby's. They'd get chicken wings. There'd be a Chevy Volt in every barn. They'd get rid of the camels and plug in a car. 4 years ago, Obama went on a reconciliation tour with the Muslim world, bowed down to them, kissed the rings, apologized for being an American. And look where we are today. Middle East policy in ruins. His naivete in believing that one only needed to adopt a new tone and show more respect in order to get rid of the thousand-year-old insanity is insane.
I'll be right back.
Savage.
The jihadists learned one thing under the weakling, Neville Chamberlain Obama. Neville Obama. We'll call him Neville Obama. The jihadists learned one thing about Neville Obama, which is that we have no deterrent power left, and that the superpower simply wants, all they want is love. All you need is love. In other words, Obama could be singing the Beatles tune, all we need is love right now. But they, he doesn't understand that you have to scare them to keep them in check. In other words, you don't send them more money. You send them a drone, more drones, not less drones. 3 years after Obama's speech in Cairo, which was supposed to initiate a new beginning in the Middle East, the United States now has even less support in the region than before. Naked hatred raging against America that many people in the world regard as a symbol of freedom. They burn our flags. They vandalize our embassies. They kill our diplomats. Right? What are they saying? It's not about the movie. They're saying drop dead. We don't want freedom. We love serfdom. We want to go backwards, not forwards. We want to live in chains. We don't want your rotten freedom. We don't want your democracy. We don't want your books. We want no books. We believe in the single sufficiency of the single book, the Quran. It's all we want. So that's their right. I'm not saying that they shouldn't believe in the sufficiency of the single book, the Quran. If that's what they want, let them have it. But we shouldn't be there. Pull out. Take our interests out of there. What do we need? What do they have that we need? What do you say? Oil. All right. Open up the Keystone XL pipeline. Immediately start drilling off the California coast and send Barbara Boxer to Syria. Say national interests trump her insanity. Okay, drill off the California coast, drill off the coast of Alaska, which they're doing already, and open up the Keystone XL pipeline, start fracking, and suddenly we don't need the Arabs. They can take it and they can suck sand, so to speak. And that's it. It's the end of the problem. So you say, what about Israel? That's their problem. That's all. That's all. It's their problem. I can't see this country dying for the tail. How do you like that? You don't want me to say that? Israel's a powerful little country. They have, what, 30, 40 atom bombs or whatever they have? Give them all the weapons they need. Give them all the military support they need and get out of there. Just forget about it. If they want to go backwards 1,000 years around them, there's nothing we can do about it. Nothing. Obama was warned by intelligent people that Mubarak, once you Gaddafi a year ago in Libya was saying you should not try to overthrow me because these are the tribes from eastern Libya that you're aiding. These are tribes. They live in another century. And if you get rid of me, Gaddafi said, you're going to have tribalism and you're going to create, which what Libya was a phenomenal country. You're going to create a Somalia in northern Africa. Well, that's what Obama created, a Somalia in northern Africa. Remember Black Hawk Down? In other words, roving bands of murderers with no central government. Why? I'll go back. All right? The eye that alters all. Obama's eyes were altered as a child into thinking America was inferior, no good, whatever, racist, whatever. Throw in any words that the third world was superior, good, advanced. The rice table in Indonesia was more preferable to the Thanksgiving table. Instead of the image of the pilgrims celebrating with a turkey, he ate at the rice table of Indonesia, to put it in a culinary sense. Many little dishes around the table instead of one big, disgusting American feast. No feasting. We eat, we nibble in the third world. We nibble on light bites, and that's why we're lean. That's why we have some half insane most of the day, and that's why we say burn, baby, burn. Sort of the eight-trap brown of the world. It's like the 60s. Now, you see, you don't understand, the liberals actually like the fires. They feel young again, and they feel youthful. It's like just something good going on over there in their mind. It's like, wow, the revolutionists come. You say, hey, moron, but they're burning. Doesn't matter. It's good. They're liberated. That's what you expect after a revolution. I only wish it was happening here in Chicago, L.A., New York, Atlanta, San Francisco, then we'd really have liberation around the world. Then we could all live with tribes roaming around with AK-47s. Wouldn't that be cool? Of course, there'd be no tenure. Yeah, no gasoline for the Prius. But that's cool, man. We'd all walk. We'd be healthier. Less cardiovascular disease. Less diabetes. We don't need medication if we're eating third world meals. We wouldn't need any of that stuff. All we have to do is eat at the rice table like Obama did as a boy. You know, that's all. So we'll all be healthier and happier. We could play backgammon and drive 57 Chevys like they do in Havana. See, that's how the liberal actually sees it. They're happy today. You don't understand this. Fire is good to them. Fire good. Fire good. Freedom bad. Now, I'm giving you a little skit here, but this is not a laughing matter. I need a little relief for myself. How much can I take? How much could I take when I see academic idiots like this ruining the world? I know you don't want to believe it. You can't believe it. The most incompetent, divisive man in American history is president. And Hillary was, when this all started in Libya, she was in the Cook Islands in a grass skirt watching a dance. She was on her magical mystery tour. Another one. Another Margaret Mead. All You Need Is Love. Play All You Need Is Love as we take, and I'll come, not a break yet. Play the Beatles. This is the theme song of the Obama administration. All You Need Is Love. Agwan Sri Obama. Watch Lawrence of Arabia. I mean, watch it again. Peter O'Toole. A strange film. There was another one who was in love with the Third World. Thought he could, you know, bring them, liberate them from the evil English. Colonialism. Evil colonialism. Bah. Humbug. We don't need colonialism. If we lived in rational times where there was a media, Obama would be finished as a president because the linchpin of his entire foreign policy has blown up in his face. It shows his incompetence and naivete, period, end of story, without any other rhetoric, end of story. But because we have no media, no independent media other than a few places here and there, and the media is becoming basically a mouthpiece for him because he owns them in the sense that he controls their ability to expand, their ability to get away without paying taxes, they are in his corner, mainly NBC and their entire outlet, which is why most of them are on drugs. Witness the guy who said, "My name is Tom Brokaw, and although I don't know whether it's morning or evening, I will collapsed during a convention. He took a sleeping pill in the morning. He thought it was evening. Who knows? What does this go back to? Savage's theme, the eye altering alters all. So the next thing we'll hear in the Middle East is a chant. What do you want? Serfdom. When do you want it? Now. What do you want? Serfdom. When do you want it? Now.
Savage.
The Middle East fires, really, to the liberal, are cleansing because they're cleansing the cities of colonial influences like Arby's or like Kentucky Fried Chicken. They'd rather go back to eating old meat with flies in it. Why? Again, goes back to be serious. The eye altering alters all. Everything's altered. You grow up with an anthropologist mother who had discontent for America, traveled the third world, worshipped the third world, only married third worlders, didn't date American men, hated the Christian roots, embraced the other roots, right? And then the son of that mother now acts it out on a world stage. So instead of the 82nd Airborne, he'll send in meditators, massage therapists, and drummers to teach to give the Arabs an opportunity to grow with us, to embrace our way of life. I met a traveler, because Ozymandias, you know that poem by Shelley, Ozymandias? Babel sent it to me. It's like a literary thing. Obama's like Ozymandias. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert, near them on the sand, half sunk a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear, my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away." Now, what does it have to do with Obama? Because he's the king. He's Ozymandias. Two vast and trunkless legs of stone standing in the desert. That is the visage of Obama's Arab Spring. I told you what it would come to, not because I wanted it to fail. God, you think I didn't want to see every Arab in a Chevy Volt? You think I didn't want to see smiling Arabs with their wife and three children with a picket fence around their tent? I did. You think I didn't want to see them happily munching on Arby's roast beef sandwiches and eating KFC Happy Wings on the weekend? I did. I wanted to see them in their Bedouin tents eating Happy Wings. I hoped it would work. But the cynic in me, the man who had been around for 8 decades now, I'm in my 8th decade, would you believe it? God, tick-tock. Ticky-tocky, ticky-tocky, no-tocky, no-ticky. Tick-tock, 8th decade. So I've seen a lot. It's like the world, da-da-da.
The guy's a failure. He's an academic goonie bird. He's a dodo with a great voice. Period. It's called sophistry, Johnson. Look it up. Look up another big word. Another colonial word, sophistry. Obama's a sophist. Look at the, you know the word sophisticated, though. It doesn't mean that. Sophistry means something else. He's an expert at sophistry. Words without meaning. So like at the funeral for the dead. Listen to this sophistry. Listen.
Chris Stevens was everything America could want in an ambassador, as the whole country has come to see. How he first went to the region as a young man in the Peace Corps.
All right, turn it off. Instead of using the funeral to rally America around the fact that his Arab Spring blew up and became what Savage said it would in his great book, Trickle Down Tyranny, The Arab Winter, which a phrase I coined, picked up by Drudge, now ripped off by the AP, which is good. It doesn't matter really who gives me credit anymore. It's just as my ideas that matter. At this point, who cares? Maybe the world will awaken before November 7th and save America from the clutches of these academic goony birds. Because they have no idea what they're doing. It's like it's like training wheels. They've been playing with a bicycle with training wheels, and they took the training wheels off, and the world caught fire. It's like, oh, wow, we got elected. Don't you remember Obama the first couple of weeks when he walked up the steps of Air Force One? He looked back like, holy God, man, I can't believe this. Alinsky's methods, and here I am. I'm walking up the steps of Air Force One. All those communists who told me we could do it, they did it. I can't believe it. He was like tentative. He could not believe it. His legs were shaking. Well, look at him now. I'm Barack Obama. I can't even go on my email anymore. Every time I go on AOL, it's, are you in? Are you in? Are you in? You want to come to his birthday party? Him and Michelle smiling. I can't take it. I don't even want to go on my email. Are you in? Are you in? Are you in? No, I'm not in. I'm out. Stop it. I got to get a new service. Yahoo's even worse. Everywhere, these children read this garbage. Yahoo News. It's Obama News. The Obama News Network. ONN. Every one of them, ONN. Romney bad. Romney goofed. Romney goofed in the Middle East. He said something. We don't know what he did, but he didn't he have something to do with causing them fires? It wasn't Obama who did it. When Romney said something, isn't that what sparked it? Didn't Romney spark all that burning? He said something that set off those nice young men with the tight pants that look like us with the Blackberries. It was Romney. Yeah, Romney did it. I watched my news on Yahoo. Romney set it on fire. Romney set the world on fire. What did he say? Well, I don't know what he said, but I know he did it. I have no idea what he said, but I know he did it. Obama had nothing. Obama tried to stop the fires. He tried to save the ambassador. There are rumors that Obama actually was there at the time, tried to save him, sent in the Marine. That's the world you live in, a world of stupid people. Lilliputians. God, it's hard. Jonathan Swift, I got to tell you, I could see why he wound up in a madhouse. I could see why he wound up in a madhouse. How much can you take? How much of reality can anyone take? It's like crawling on broken hot glass every day when you look at it. Give me a break already. How much can I take of this? Romney, please say something. Romney's sons, please tell Dad not to be afraid of the liberals in the media. Let him talk, please. He's the opposition leader he's supposed to criticize. That's how a two-party system works.
Today, we bring home four Americans who gave their lives for our country and our values.
Well, actually, they gave their lives because of your incompetence. That's enough. I don't want to play it anymore. When this all started in Libya, she was in the Cook Islands dancing with a grass skirt on her world tour. She has, if she had any shame, she would resign. If Obama had any shame, he would resign. It'd be over. The election would just be called. See, we have a very bad political system. It's a winner-take-all system, number one, which always leaves half the nation hating the other half. There's no representation. It's a winner-take-all system. This is a bad situation. I've long felt that the winner should be president and the loser should be vice president. I've always felt that. It's always been my... I think I can outdo the founding fathers with regard. You say, well, that would create gridlock. Well, we have it anyway. But at least you'd have representation somewhere. Right now, whoever wins, the other side hates them. This can't go on much longer. So right now, we have the most incompetent, divisive administration in American history. The Arab world is burning. Their incompetence is seen all over the world, except in America, because the media is owned by entities like General Electric, which pay no income tax. which, in my opinion, made a deal with the president and his minions and said, look, we won't criticize you. We'll let our little stooges have a good time. We'll let them think that they're powerful, and we'll just always support you as long as you don't make us pay an income tax. If you think I'm making it up, you're wrong. So that's the way the world works. Anyone who does art or movies knows this is how the world works. Many of you are naive to think that it doesn't work that way, but it does work that way. It's called trading favors. Now, that all worked well in America up to a point, despite the problems we've had. It worked. It's not working anymore. Because the media was supposed to be, sort of another branch, you know, of government. Supposed to be attack dogs, not lapdogs. As you well know, they become nothing but lapdogs for Obama. 1998, I gave a speech at the Commonwealth Club entitled Beware the Government Media Complex. It was really a great speech, great definition of what's going on, completely ignored by the world, but of course not by my fanatic audience here on the Savage Nation. And remember who you're listening to, in case you forgot. It's not only rated as the third largest radio show in America, even though it starts late on the East Coast, even though I'm on marginal stations in some cities, it's number two on the internet. And I've written six best-selling books in a row, six New York Times bestsellers. Put that in your liberal pipes and smoke them, including my first novel, Abuse of Power. So obviously there's a large audience for me, and the people are literate enough to buy books and read them. So what I'm saying to you represents the mindset not only of myself, but I would imagine 30 million Americans, not all of whom listen to me or read my books, but who have the same worldview. And we are seeing the world burning because of the incompetent corruption and the academic idiocy of Obama and those around him. They don't understand what's going on. The poor ambassador was like a naive Peace Corps guy. Remember, I'm a former anthropologist before I went on to a PhD in another different fields altogether. I spent many years in the Third World. I met such nice people. They're good people. The Peace Corps people are nice people. They mean well. And they always seem to assume, you know, they sat with their legs crossed in the huts. They did all the appropriate things, whether it was in Indonesia or Samoa or Tonga or Fiji. Wherever they were around Third World, as they became extremely respectful. The antithesis of their hatred for the American culture that gave them the freedom to become an anthropologist. And you say, well, what does that have to do with what we're talking about? Well, I throw that out there for the 1% listening who understands what I'm saying. Obama is sort of like an anthropologist who's running America, sort of a left-wing anthropologist from NYU, who's always had a kind of distemper for his own country and always worshipped the Third World. Somehow the Third World was superior. They had colorful costumes. They weren't rigid and uptight. They had rhythm. They had, they weren't white and Christian. That was the main thing. They were the anti-Christian. And anything that was anti-Christian was therefore superior. No, you think I'm making this up. You don't understand that this is actually the zeitgeist of the Obama administration. The entire administration sees the world through that lens. It's a warped lens. Who was it who wrote, "The eye that alters all"? I didn't sleep well. I've been itching. My skin itches. I'm so tense from world events. I'm so tense from the insanity going on around me in the world. I'm so tense from the fact that I'm living in the ex-Soviet Union, where there's no media representing the world as it is. For example, I mean, the Middle East is burning. This should immediately be the end of the election. Romney should immediately win. This immediately shows you Obama's an incompetent moron. The linchpin of his foreign policy just blew up in his face. Here, quote me. Savage says the linchpin of Obama's foreign policy just exploded in his face. Right? That's it. It's over. In a participatory democracy, in a parliamentary system, there'd be a vote of no confidence and Obama would be voted out. That would be the end of him. He'd go back to whatever he was doing before. We don't have to categorize it beyond what we've already said. Alinsky, a street agitator, community organizer, fine, well and good. Let him go back to his academic roots, whatever they were. But it's not going to be that way in this country. Although the Middle East is burning, the Lilliputians in the media are focusing on a few words that Romney uttered after the ambassador was sodomized and killed, or just simply killed. We don't know whether he was actually sodomized, but he was mutilated and killed. His body was desecrated either before he was killed or after he was killed. But he was definitely mutilated by the Arab mobs, because that's what they do to the enemy. Again, you don't want to know that. You don't want to hear it, because after all, they're third worlders, and they're superior to you. They're not Christians. Therefore, they must be somehow better than you. Christians, after all, are bad. Well, they conducted the whatever. It was the, what was it called? The Crusades. Of course, the average idiot doesn't understand that the first crusade was a Muslim crusade to convert Christian nations to Islam. You don't want to know that, because that would change things around for you. The Christian crusades you hear about are actually a counter crusade against the Muslim crusades, but that would require thinking and history. We don't want to go there.
Savage.
You know, it's no secret that the midstream media tears apart everything that Romney says while ignoring almost every scandal and every lie of Obama. Joining us now on the Savage Nation is Jen Gratz with Words Matter 2012, whose research project is taking a strong look into the promises that President Obama has made and how he's not keeping them. Jen Gratz, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about your project.
Words Matter 2012 developed out of a research project. We were researching what President Obama said on the campaign trail, and we started really noticing that he talks a great game, and many people got caught up in what he said in 2008. And we wanted to highlight what he said in 2008 and ask people if he's delivered. In 2008, he said that the American public needs to trust that politicians are saying what they mean and meaning what they say. And Words Matter 2012 explores if the president has followed through on that promise.
Well, how long have you been actually doing this?
We started releasing weekly videos in March, and we've released 29 videos to date, all on different subjects of President Obama saying one thing on the campaign trail in 2008, and seemingly doing something different while in office. And we ask viewers to decide if the president should be trusted with a second term.
What kind of videos?
Well, they run the gamut. Our most recent release is called Obama, a Post-Racial President. And we explore if Obama has been the unifier that he promised to be. I'm sure that your listeners remember that even as far back as 2004, Obama was talking about uniting the country. We're not a red state, blue state. We're not black America, white America. We are the United States of America. And there isn't anybody in this country that would disagree with that sentiment, conservative or liberal. People agree with that sentiment. And that's one of the sticking points with the president. He talks a good game. He talks about things that sound good to everyone. But has he delivered? And so we explore if he's delivered on uniting the country with respect to race. And we remind people of the incident at Harvard with Professor Gates, where he ended up calling the Cambridge Police Department. He said that they acted stupidly. We explore a couple other issues with respect to race and ask viewers to decide if the president is a post-racial president.
Well, do you plan on doing this after the election?
Well, we absolutely hope it's an ongoing theme. We think that it's important. We think that our politicians should be held accountable. It just happens that we started this election cycle. But if Romney is elected, we hope to also hold him accountable for the promises that he's making to the American people today.
What feedback have you received?
We've gotten really good feedback on the videos. You know, people are, a lot of people hear the red meat from, say, Karl Rove, and that's exciting to hear, and that fires up the base. But to have something to be able to share with your friends and family who may not want the red meat the red meat videos and the red meat issues, that want to explore in a softer tone. And so these types of videos allow people to share information with their friends and family that may not have the time to do the research that really needs to be done to be educated in this election.
Well, are you planning on expanding to other areas of government?
We would love to. And if funding allowed us to, we would absolutely explore further and hold all politicians accountable. The project started with the president because in 2008, February 2008, Obama gave a speech in Wisconsin that he self-titled Words Matter. This wasn't an idea that we came up with. He gave a speech where he said that his words mattered. And he gave this speech in response to Hillary Clinton, who at the time was questioning him. And she actually said that Obama was peddling false hopes and that he was all words and no action. And so the premise of the project became, was Hillary Clinton right? Did the president peddle a bunch of false hopes? And is he just words and no action?
Where can we read more?
You can go to www.wordsmatter2012.com or to our YouTube page, which is youtube.com/wordsmatter2012.
Jen Gratz, thank you.